Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinner, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. A new and extremely detailed report about Tajikistan's military has been released by the Washington-based Axis Society for Central Asian Affairs. Tajikistan's civil war of 1992 to 1997 provided a chilling look at what could happen more generally across Central Asia, something that weighs on the minds of leaders in Astana, Ashgabat, Bishkek, and Tashkent to this day. Tajikistan also continues to face unique security challenges, both the potential militant threats inside the country and flare-ups along its borders. Adding to the difficulties of assembling a capable defense against these problems, Tajikistan is also the poorest country in Central Asia. The Axis Society report traces the formation of Tajikistan's armed forces, analyzes its performance and development over the course of 33 years, looks at the various structures tasked with providing defense and security, their chain of command, budgets, and which countries are helping Tajikistan. And to discuss all this, I'm joined by two of the authors of this detailed report, Michael Hilliard, who is the host of the Red Line podcast that deals with military and security matters around the world, Derek Bisaccio, Forecast International's lead analyst for international defense markets, specializing in the defense trade in Eurasia and Middle East regions. Thank you all for joining me. First thing is, Michael, could you give me a little bit about the background of this? I mean, what went into the research of this and the preparations for this long and very thorough report that you guys produced?
So the report has been about a year in works, and it's been a massive project to put together because the scope of this just kind of grew and grew. And I think it came out of the fact that every other one of my colleagues or everyone I talk to who focuses on other defense spheres always tends to have these great reports and great charts and everything ready and explaining how the militaries work, what they've got, where the bases are, except for Central Asia. And there wasn't this resource you could kind of go to and understand how these militaries work. So we wanted to do a full kind of 1,000-page analysis on everything you need to know about the Central Asian militaries, where they're funded, the historical events that have driven them to where they are, what they use. And obviously, we didn't want to release all 1,000 pages at once. I think that's a bit overwhelming for most people. So we decided to go chapter by chapter. And the first chapter is Tajikistan, effectively going through everything you need to know about the Tajik armed forces as well as security services. As well as an interactive map showing, all 200 military locations across Tajikistan, with obviously as each chapter comes out, the map for that country comes out as well. So it's mostly just been out of frustration that I think every other, all my colleagues who work at the Russia desks or work Europe or work Africa or have all these great resources, and Central Asia unfortunately didn't. So it's good to finally get one put together for it.
No, thank you very much. Derek, can you talk a little bit? I know there's many chapters in this report on Tajikistan, but can you talk a little bit about the early days of Tajikistan's military development? I mean, what were some of the challenges it faced in the first decade of independence?
Yeah, so thank you, Bruce, for having me on. One of the first problems that Tajikistan had was right at independence. They, unlike the rest of their neighbors, didn't inherit any military units from the Soviet Union. So they had no existing armed forces structure. They had very little equipment. And then very, very quickly, the country fell into a civil war as it had elite infighting and it had different areas of the country that were attempting to carve out power for themselves. So very, very quickly, Tajikistan was in a crisis and without a whole lot of tools to respond to it. So they relied very heavily on Russia. They relied very heavily on Uzbekistan to help them succeed in that war. And then thereafter, they were faced with this problem of now we need to stand up an armed forces from scratch. So what they ended up doing was the pro-government militias, the ones that helped Rahman win the war, were then effectively just converted into an armed forces structure. So many of those units then just basically took on a new uniform and said, okay, great, now you are the Tajik armed forces. That, because they don't have that legacy from of Soviet units that the other countries have, that means they don't have as much training, they don't have as much experience. And then certainly the equipment that they've put together has been a lot of donated equipment. It's been either things that the Russians or the Soviets left behind or have now provided to them for free or cheap of cost. And it's very difficult for them to maintain that equipment, let alone acquire new ones.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Michael, What do you think are some of the key lessons that, that the Tajik authorities learned from the civil war? Your report mentions Mahmud Hudaybardiya, for instance. So, of course, they have the battlefield opponents, the opposition. But even within the Tajik, what was the Tajik military as it existed at that time? They had a lot of problems, and they couldn't even depend on some of their own military units to necessarily obey orders. What I'm asking again is, what are some of the lessons you think the authorities learned from the developments during the civil war as they decided to craft their military in the post-civil war years?
I think there's quite a few lessons they took from the civil war. One is obviously the geography. The geography of the country very much determines where the troops are going to be, how they're set out, which parts get which, and making sure that they can, deploy into the Central Valley or deploy down south or deploy toward Horog. I think the biggest lesson, though, was about who Rahman could trust. And that's why we do tend to see that the, units down toward Holob in Vos and in Dangara tend to be, pretty comparatively better equipped. When you look at the guys in Dushanbe, for instance, he's made sure that he doesn't have to just trust one particular unit, one particular group. He has things like the 7th Air Assault Brigade, which is just to the east of the city. But he also has the National Guard, which operates directly under Rahman's control. But he also has the Ministry of Internal Affairs troops. And that way he makes sure that even if one of them was to turn against the government, the other two could effectively defend the government. And he makes sure that there are always these built-in safety catches that even if there was any betrayal or problems, the government there is always someone to defend Dushanbe and defend Rahman. It's interesting how much of this kind of safety catch has been built into the entire Tajik armed forces and where who gets what resources, where they are, and how much ability each unit has to be able to react to the other side of the country. So there is still a lot of the scars, I think, whether it be in doctrine or whether it be just from Rahman himself, that he would have acquired in the Civil War that are probably still very much driving Tajik defense policy today.
Mm-hmm, thanks. Derek, Michael just mentioned something about the way that the forces were distributed so that the Rahman could always depend on one in the event one of them turned on him. Now, during the Civil War, I remember there was a time when the Interior Ministry, and it was run by a person named Yaqub Salimov, who was an infamous character in Tajik history, but a Russian official showed up and said the Interior Ministry has 20,000 troops. It's more than the army of this country has. So, understanding that really, at the end of the day, that Tajikistan's biggest threat is really the internal threat. That's what all the governments in Central Asia are worried about. How do they balance the Interior Ministry and still meet the needs of the actual defense ministry? What's the balance between those two at the moment?
Yeah, so how he'll go about doing that, at least on the military side, they have acquired some equipment, and where we've seen that go is to the capital. So if we're talking about, revolving power structures and how do you balance one of these out, a lot of the newest equipment has gone to, Michael mentioned it, the 7th Air Assault Brigade around Dushanbe. They're the ones that have shown up with the new armored vehicles, the new multiple rocket launchers when they've gotten delivered, probably as well the new unmanned aerial vehicles. So even though Tajikistan doesn't have a whole lot of money to work with, what they've been able to do, or at least what Rahman's been looking to do, is build up as much as he can with particular units that could then play off of each other or at least neutralize one another in the event one of them felt like they got a little bit too much authority and wanted to challenge Rahman.
Okay, thanks. Michael, we're going to talk a little bit about the Russian, the 201st Division's base there. But one of the questions I want to ask you now has to deal specifically with the caliber of troops that Tajikistan gets. Now, the 201st has offered better paying contracts to Tajik citizens to join them, and also they get Russian citizenship. How much has that affected the quality of the soldiers that are actually taken into the Tajik military?
So it really depends on what branch you're talking about. So there is obviously the Russians do offer better pay than what the Tajiks do. But if you are, let's say, going to the Tajik ground forces, yes, the Russian 201st do offer a far better contract. But you can also make much more operating in the Tajik border service if you're willing to be, working on the Afghan border and willing to look the other way when certain things cross the border. You can also get more prestige by working in something like the Tajik Mobile Forces or one of the very specialized units of the MIA or the Ministry of Internal Affairs. So the Russians have kind of taken away some of the better recruits, but it's not completely unexpected considering that the majority of Tajik's ground forces, and again, there is a differentiation between the ground forces and the mobile forces, but the ground forces are majority just conscripts and fairly basically trained. So most of them will be the guys that Russia won't really be looking at. Russia will most likely want to be pinching from the mobile forces or some of the better police units or some of the better MIA units. But yes, it definitely has driven this kind of, should I go toward the mobile forces where there might be more prestige, or should I go to the Russian 201st where I might get better pay? But that's been the kind of consideration for quite a while now. But regardless of which, all of them will still be receive less money than what you can make on the southern Afghan border.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to ask both you guys these questions, but I'll start with you first, Derek. In the report, it mentions that Tajikistan has the smallest military. Of course, they're strapped for funding a lot of times too. But the one thing that Tajik military, at least some forces at the border guards, can claim that really no other government in Central Asia has been able to claim is they have regular experience under fire, right? It's the Afghan border, and it's also the Kyrgyz border. So even though they have a small military and it's underfunded, they have a unique experience among Central Asian troops. So where do you think that leaves Tajikistan as far as fighting capability?
So it's a very good point that even though they have the smallest military and they're not very well funded, they also have some of the best experiences, especially their troops or their border troops have often been involved in shootouts against either Taliban or other militants coming from Afghanistan. And there's a certain level of savviness that comes with this when you've been experiencing these kind of conflicts for a while. That knowledge of how to respond to it, of how to respond to incursions, of what your opponents might be attempting to do or where weakness points come in, that all comes from actually seeing this on the, in a real life scenario. Now, all these militaries will drill military exercises. They'll do it either together or independently. They'll often do it with Russia. And those are important. Those are very helpful, but nothing compares to the real thing. So they have, of course, a lot of experience from the civil war itself, and seeing how that played out, and particularly the fact that they were having to deal with cross-border incursions throughout the civil war. Now into the present era, that gives them a lot more confidence, at least in dealing with threats from the border that perhaps some of their neighbors don't have, because they aren't used to seeing a lot of these incursions. Now, Tajikistan itself is a little bit of the buffer state for a lot more of Central Asia from Afghanistan's problems. So that puts Tajikistan noticeably in the front lines as it is. But that does mean that they have, refined their command structure a little bit more, so they know how to respond to contingencies as they break out. And again, that they're aware of the sorts of threats that could manifest, whereas some of their neighbors might be just kind of shooting in the dark a little bit in terms of what they're trying to respond to.
Okay, thank you. And Michael, the same question. And let me add just one piece. When the 2021 and 2022 conflicts along the Kyrgyz border, I got the impression anyway that the Tajik military was so effective in combating the Kyrgyz forces because they had this kind of border experience. I mean, in both cases, Tajik forces crossed into Kyrgyz territory. Is that the sense that you got that actually in terms of combat experience, the Tajiks have a superiority the other Central Asians can't claim?
It's a little more complicated because obviously the Tajik border service itself is quite disconnected from the rest of the military. In fact, the entire border service operates under the command of the State Committee for National Security, effectively what used to be the Tajik KGB. And it has no civilian oversight, no parliamentary oversight. It effectively operates under the security services, which operate directly under the president. So they are completely separate. And what's happened over the years is that, China, Russia, the EU, all these countries have realized that once, heroin or terrorism or whatever gets into Central Asia or gets into Tajikistan, it's a lot easier for it to then get out to the rest of Central Asia and then on to the European and Russian markets. So a lot of these countries, particularly China in the last few years, have been throwing money at the Tajik border service to effectively try and keep the border with Afghanistan as streamlined as possible. Even if it doesn't completely combat the drug problem, make sure there isn't huge amounts of militants or Afghans crossing the border So it's been a comparatively well-funded service compared to particularly the ground forces. And they are able to make a lot of money doing contraband and a few other things as well. So you have this service that, you know, everyone has been throwing money at for years because Tajikistan is seen as the front line coming out of Afghanistan, obviously, because Turkmenistan, once you get past Sahatabat, it's just desert for a very long way. Uzbekistan is mostly having to cross a river and one particularly well-guarded bridge. So Tajikistan becomes the obvious crossing point. Because it's been so well-funded, you now have troops that are, you know, comparatively well-armed in some ways, yeah, and comparatively well-trained because you can make a lot more money there so that if you're a really good recruit, quite often you'd want to be part of the Taji Border Service. So you have this service now that is getting a lot more funding from outside sources as well, with the least civilian accountability out of all the branches, apart from maybe the National Guard, but it's a very small branch. And that same border service is monitoring both the Afghan border, but also the border with Kyrgyzstan. The clashes in 2021 and 2022, yes, the Tajiks were comparatively well-positioned. They did well, but there was a bit of a hiccup for the Tajiks, being that the Kyrgyz sent access to drones. In fact, they just had their drones rock up from Turkey, the TB2s, operating out of Jalalabad, you know, only a week or two prior to the big 2022 clashes. And that really did change the battlefield into Kyrgyzstan, into Kyrgyzstan's favor. So there is a, you know, they did probably better man-to-man than what the Kyrgyz did, but the tech really kind of, by day two of that conflict, threw it back to Kyrgyzstan. And I think that's really set the tone for where military spending between them has been going since then. But again, this is a force that is the least civilian accountable, but also has so much money being thrown at it from all sorts of sources, as everyone relies on it to be this kind of the barrier between Central Asia and Afghanistan.
If I could just follow up, it was mentioned in the report too that Kyrgyzstan is outspending Tajikistan in terms of military spending at the moment. Is that true?
Very much so. They're spending. We saw a big uptick in 2022, and then we saw kind of a downturn after that in 2023, 2024 from Tajikistan. Some of that will be effectively just rebuying things that were destroyed during the 2020 conflict. Some of it will be forward spending on projects, particularly things like drone programs, a few other bits and pieces, you know, obviously with a lot of procurement stuff. And I'm sure Derek can go through this in more detail, but you have to quite often pay a bit of a lump sum to get the production chain started. And then it's a little bit less afterwards. There's also a good chunk of Kyrgyzstan's military spending. And we kind of cover this a lot more in the Kyrgyzstan chapter, but of Kyrgyzstan buying things that are then re-exported into the Russian market. So there is, you know, the numbers on Kyrgyzstan, yes, they are spending more than the Tajiks by a fair chunk, but the numbers are a little bit squishy because of the fact that some of those items are being re-exported into the Russian market. So yeah, they are outspending and putting a lot better equipment into the area than what the Tajiks are able to respond with. You know, if we look at what's in Batken these days, they've been introducing Belarusian air defense systems. They've been beefing up the units up there. They've been stationing more contract soldiers rather than conscripts, improving the amount of training time these guys get, buying a lot more drones, producing their own drones. And Tajikistan really hasn't had anywhere near a comparable response up toward Batken yet. So, you know, since 2022, I think that was a big shock to the system for the Kyrgyz, and it is forming this kind of arms race that Kyrgyzstan is very much winning at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Derek, what are the priorities for the Tajik military and security forces at the moment with the funds and the help they have?
Right. So they have the most important security priority for them is going to be protection of Rahman and his regime. So protecting the capital. Outside of that, of course, they're going to need to watch the border with Afghanistan, and they need to increasingly worry about, as Michael was putting it, the fact that they're losing an arms race with Kyrgyzstan. That for them is going to be the most important area of procurement, in the sense that for most of the threats from Afghanistan, they can handle that with isolated troops, with border posts, and with UAVs providing surveillance. With Kyrgyzstan, they have more of an instance of, say, what you might call a peer rival, and that's going to require a lot more conventional fighting, which they don't have a whole lot of equipment for, and they have very little money to acquire. So what we've seen as far as where they're putting what little spending they have, they've started opening up new UAV plants. There was one that got a lot of headlines in 2022. They opened up an Ababil 2 plant with help from Iran. Those are reconnaissance drones. They could certainly try to put explosives on them and turn them into loitering munitions, the sort of thing we've seen on the battlefield in Ukraine or in Nagorno-Karabakh. They've also begun setting up some armored vehicle production plants so they can produce 4x4 armored vehicles. But they're well behind Kyrgyzstan in that. And it seems to be certainly something that's kind of kicked them into a little bit of overdrive. They've even gone to Turkey to see if they can negotiate for the TB2s. Kyrgyzstan shot that down in 2022. They publicly urged Turkey not to complete that sale. And to date, it doesn't appear that they have, although the following year, Turkey did extend. It was about $1.5 million in grant funding for Tajikistan to move forward with equipment from the Turkish industry. We haven't seen them do anything with that yet, to my knowledge, but that is out there. So they're playing with a very limited deck of cards, but it certainly seems that the primary worry as far as a procurement standpoint is how do they counter all of this equipment that's gone into the Kyrgyz armed forces, because Kyrgyzstan has acquired now at least three different armed Turkish drone platforms and probably a fourth as well that give them a lot more capabilities and gives Kyrgyzstan the ability to hit targets with precision that Tajikistan might not be expecting. It could be behind the lines in a given conflict, and they're not used to having to protect that. So that's been their real concern.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder, we're talking about the recently released report from the Oxus Society for Central Asia on Tajikistan's armed forces. And my guests are two of the authors of that report, Derek Bisaccio, Forecast International's lead analyst for international defense markets, specializing in defense trade in the Eurasia and Middle East regions, and Michael Hilliard, the host of the Redline podcast that deals with military and security matters around the world. Thanks again, gentlemen. Let's talk a little bit about who's helping Tajikistan with its military and its security forces, but let's start by looking at a review of what kind of military equipment does Tajikistan actually have at the moment. Michael?
So a lot of it, you know, a lot of it is effectively stuff that was probably manufactured in the 60s and 70s by the Soviets. A lot of it would probably have seen service, you know, in Russia or Ukraine as reserve units and then been put, you know, eventually resold back to the Tajiks at some point. It's pretty old tanks. It's pretty old artillery. A lot of it's seen better days. You know, a lot of their, you know, basic armored vehicles are going to be Russian stuff as well. We're talking BTRs, BMPs, you know, it's a lot of stuff, not a lot of very recent equipment sitting in the stockpiles here. They have got some, you know, goodies that have come in, but generally it is pretty old Russian stuff, which is usually cheap and easy to maintain. And Derek will give great answer on this one as well, I assume, but I don't see them changing that pattern for a while. We did see them sort of move to China a little bit during 2022 when the price of Russian exports is really high. But, you know, since Russia has kind of got their arms capacity back up to a point where it can kind of satisfy its domestic needs and the needs for the war and fulfill its export market needs, you know, we have seen a kind of return back to using Russian equipment or standardization kits or modernization kits for the older platforms they have, you know, putting a new gearbox in a very old BMP so you can buy another 5 years in use out of it, you know. So, yeah, the Tajik military of 2024 effectively looks very similar to the Tajik military of 1985.
Okay, thank you. Derek, yeah, could you talk a little bit about the military equipment of Tajikistan? But also, I'm kind of curious that we're going to talk more about Russia's role, but the 201st, they've been withdrawing, cannibalizing equipment and personnel from the 201st Division. Now, this is, of course, the ultimate guarantee of security in Tajikistan. It certainly was during the Civil War era for the regime, and really has been in time of crises before, the fact that there are these Russians stationed there at this base. But has Russia started to replenish everything that it took out from the 201st to move over to Ukraine?
At least on that end, some of the equipment that the Russians brought to the 201st in the immediate years just before launching that invasion of Ukraine, some of that equipment has still stayed there. That being the newest BTRs, the latest modification for their T-72s. It certainly a lot of that has been cycled out. There's no reason why they'd be pulling. If you look at what Russia's been doing with its armed forces in that conflict, they've had to pull tons and tons of equipment out of storage to send it into Ukraine. So there's no reason they would leave the most modern kit in Tajikistan just to hang out in Dushanbe while providing their armed forces with very old kit that's going into war. Having said that, they at least have left a modicum of that equipment in Tajikistan. If you watch some of the more recent military exercises that they've done, that Russia and Tajikistan have done, those BTRs and those T-72s are still there, or at least some of them. But I would imagine that the quantity has certainly gone down. There's certainly a question of how well that equipment is being maintained, considering that Russia has, you know, an overbearing focus on needing to maintain and repair and replace all the equipment that it's losing in Ukraine. I have to imagine that the deployment in Tajikistan has suffered. And then as far as personnel, I believe that anywhere up to about 1,500 201st personnel have been reported to be in Ukraine at a given time. That started off, there were troops troops from the 201st in Ukraine pretty much right towards the start of the war. There were reports of casualties from service members attached to that unit within a month or two of the conflict starting. So they've been there throughout the entirety of that war. What that does for Tajikistan is it's very unnerving. If you look at it from the on paper perspective, the 201st, its size, or at least at its peak strength, rivals that of the Tajik armed forces. So that is definitely, it's a structure that Tajikistan itself leans on. It's a security blanket. They know that if anything, you know, the worst happens, or if it's an incursion from abroad, if it's a instance of internal turmoil where one of the elite unit commanders decides he wants to try to take on the presidency, the idea is that the Russians will come ride to the rescue and help Rahman out. That it's very concerning for him, with Russia's focus being away from the region, with seeing fewer presence in Tajikistan. That leaves them in a very awkward state, and I think that even might be one of the reasons why why Rahman has delayed presidential transition.
Great, and thank you. You've opened the door for the next point. Let's talk about what other countries are helping out Tajikistan with its security and defense needs, and why they're helping them at the same time. Michael, who else? Okay, Russia's still there, kind of limited in what it can do at the moment. The Tajik government, as Derek said, got to be a little bit worried about the equipment and personnel that were transferred over to Ukraine from Russia's base there in Tajikistan. So who's Tajikistan turning to try to shore up some of these weakened areas that have been left behind by Russia's distracted attention?
So Tajikistan has a pretty fascinating, you know, group of people, a group of countries working inside at the moment. Russia still keeps, you know, the Dushanbe has obviously been pretty depleted for the war in Ukraine. Bokhtar is the 201st base down there, is fairly functional still. Nurek, there's the Okno space station that operates under the Russian Space Forces. That's still at full strength, operating as usual. We also have seen, you know, S-300s, which are fairly decent air defense systems, actually far better than almost anything else in Central Asia, apart from what Kazakhstan has, are operating in the country as well. That's part of Russia's, or the CSTO, sorry, CSTO's Joint Regional Air Defense System. This is a deal that, you know, they put these S-300s in the west of Tajikistan. Kyrgyzstan's about to receive its deployment of S-300s as well. I think that's more just to shore up, you know, the relationship with Russia. China has been the big other player in here, but I think what the Chinese are doing and how they operate here is a little sometimes misunderstood. They have a, you know, facility in the very, very southeast of the country near Kizilrobot. It's a fairly decent facility. It was originally a joint facility run by China and Tajikistan together, but now it's just a Chinese facility. But it's not run by the Chinese army. It's run by the Chinese People's Armed Police. So it's more of a paramilitary unit. China has effectively had a bit of a shock from operating in southern Pakistan, where they've had this terrible loop start where facilities that are owned by the Chinese come under attack from locals, mostly because the Chinese people are paid more, they have better conditions, the locals get annoyed, they attack the Chinese facility. China has then fired upon locals in Pakistan. Pakistanis have responded by firing upon the Chinese personnel, So the Chinese have had to increase their security presence in southern Pakistan, which then only amplifies the problem. And there's this loop that started up in Balochistan. China's desperately trying to avoid that here in Tajikistan. So instead of putting massive amounts of its own personnel in, they put some, they put some guys in, about 300 down near in that facility we were talking about earlier on. The rest is just throwing money at the Tajik border forces to try and convince them to put on a whole bunch of additional forces. They're also throwing money at the Tajik MIA to try and get them to get going a new rapid response battalion to operate around near the Afghan border in the south there. On top of that, they do have some private security contractors that operate there as well, mostly operating in places like Khulob. They also have environmental monitoring stations, which, whilst yes, could be used for monitoring climate change, can also be used for military purposes if China was to decide to do so. So they have been, getting more and more involved in the security of Tajikistan, but it is almost through Tajikistan rather than doing it themselves in the way the Russians have done in the past. The other operator in here is India. India at one point was looking like it'd be a bigger partner for Tajikistan. In fact, the big airbase in the country, Aini, which is just the west of Dushanbe, the Indians paid a lot of money into that at the start, and then Russia lent on them because it was going to be a joint Indian-Tajik base. Russia lent on them, told them, no, this is going to be a joint Russian-Tajik base. They kicked the Indians out, and now the Indians effectively operate only a few small personnel out of the India-Tajikistan Friendship Hospital, which is in Bokhtar, and they have access to operate out of Farkhor Air Base, which is in the very south of the country, right near the border with Afghanistan, which was very useful during parts of the war on terror, but today really isn't used that much. Frankly, the reason it was used is because it was too dangerous to fly into Kabul. Pakistan wasn't allowing overflight rights there for a while. So they had to kind of find somewhere to put down planes, they get into unload trucks and go into Afghanistan. These days with Kabul operating much like any other normal airport, it's really not that useful. And there's no Indian planes on the ground. There's no personnel there. So the Indian presence has shrunk down quite a lot. But yeah, Russia's still probably the most hands-on, even though their base is about half capacity at the moment. China is doing more of a third-party thing, and then India is a very, very small presence in the country.
Okay, thanks. Derek, can you talk about some of the other players that are involved in this? Now, you already mentioned that Iran has set up a drone base in a drone construction production base in Tajikistan. But I mean, over the years, a lot of Western governments have been helping Tajikistan out too. Not so much the military, although that happens too, but certainly, getting back to what Michael said, border security, especially on the Afghan border, has been a priority for a long, long time in Tajikistan. I know the United States has helped them. Governments in Europe have helped them. Can you talk a little bit about that help that they've received from the West?
Yes, certainly. So that for the West in particular, while the United States was leading the operation in Afghanistan, it only made sense to develop ties with the countries around for the sake of border security or for the sake of even just for logistics purposes to assist the operation in Afghanistan. And we've seen that wax and wane depending on the West's focus on Afghanistan. So, of course, 2021 happens, Afghan government collapses, the United States is pulled out, and that's really led to a turn of focus away from the region. But one of the interesting parts with this is that when the Afghan government collapsed, dozens of aircraft that were under the Afghan National Army flew to Uzbekistan and flew to Tajikistan. They're still there. Uzbekistan over this past summer, I believe, was able to negotiate an agreement to keep its aircraft. Tajikistan still in negotiations for it. And the basic format of those talks is that the U.S. wants to get either assurances or wants to get agreements with Tajikistan regarding border security and regarding stopping terrorism in exchange for transferring those aircraft. And it's not a small number of aircraft when you look at Tajikistan's air force and what they actually have. It was always a tangential player to the Afghan policy writ large, but I think certainly the West has viewed it as you don't want a recurrence of civil war in Tajikistan. So where possible, help synchronize with the other efforts to build up the Tajik border forces, keep that stable, and prevent the government from collapsing.
Thank you. Michael, let's stick with the Afghan border for a second. Now, this is a threat that the Tajik government has been using for years and years. It's kind of to keep the flow of aid and military assistance coming into the region. There's thousands of militants just on the other side of the border, hundreds of, radical madrasas teaching suicide bombers, all these kind of things that, and I've even said in the past that peace in Afghanistan would be the worst thing that could happen for Tajikistan, actually. So how effective are they? And are they less effective in playing that card than they were in the past? Or are they still able to, every time they think they need more money, are they still able to say, oh, we have 4,000 militants on our border and we need help?
So it's a bit of both. What we found is that the Tajiks will report, an ISK attack along the border somewhere. There's been very few serious attacks, the most recent one being near Sadik in May of 2022, where there's some rockets fired in from Afghanistan. Most of these attacks today are fairly small, and you kind of read the press release and it's, an attack across the border, and then you actually go and call people in the village and ask what actually happened, and it seems to be more like a drunken farmer on the other side taking pot shots. But there's this kind of loop built into it, unfortunately, where the Tajik border service has a bit of an financial incentive to, amp up how dangerous things are across the border, because then, Russia, the EU, through Bomka, through all these guys have an incentive to throw money at them. And ISK also has an incentive to amplify how dangerous they are in the region, because obviously that would get them more funding from, rich people in the Gulf or benefactors, because they seem like more of a serious threat. So there is always a pinch of salt in this with what reports come out of it, because everyone is incentivized to, build up the danger across this border a little bit. Saying that, there is some concerns. I think the biggest concern, particularly for the Tajik security services, has been the appearance of publications like The Voice of Khorasan, which is a ISK published, literature, effectively calling for the end of the government in Dushanbe and a complete overthrow, and that's starting to appear in places in Gordo Badakhshan. That's obviously a concern for the government. So they are getting better at fighting them. They are pretty good at keeping the border somewhat stable, but we also haven't seen, particularly up here in the sort of very northeast of Afghanistan, ISK be able to coordinate themselves in a very, very, large manner. Most of their movements have been, very sporadic, single to, kind of a handful of fighters, rather than any sort of massive ability to launch incursions or launch massive attacks like we've seen from particularly IS itself.
Okay, we're getting toward the 40-minute mark, so we're going to have to wrap this up. But, Michael, I'll start with you so I can give Derek the last word here. But when you were researching this report about Tajikistan, did you come across anything surprising? Was there something there you didn't expect you would find out?
Oh, so much of this was surprising. Whether it be some of the pretty poor operational security in some of this, but a lot of it was just interesting on how much of the entire system has been built around prioritizing internal security. And, as much as they are buying new weaponry, as much as there is this kind of arms race going on, almost everything is still prioritized around that. So, for instance, you see Kyrgyzstan buying these new air defense systems and you see them arming to be better prepared for an incursion in the future, but they're also not buying the fuel stations, the mobile refuelers, the logistics trucks, all the kind of things you'd need if you were hoping to launch an invasion. So it's interesting to see that there's all this bluster on improving capabilities on both, pretty much all of these militaries, but there really isn't this building the kind of logistical networks and frameworks that you would need to launch any invasions. So, it's a bit calming, I guess, or a bit reassuring that none of these guys are prepared to go to war or, look like they're actually looking to go to war. Even Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, who are the, obvious contenders to fight each other, it seems to be more of both sides know that by day 4 or 5, the outside players are going to step in and say, hey, we need to resolve this. And they want to be in a better position at the end of day 4 rather than thinking they could maybe launch a massive campaign to go take Khojand or take Osh or they know it's going to be very limited. So everyone is kind of almost building their militaries around internal security and political theater rather than building them around, what a conventional kind of US or German or Russian military would build their militaries around. It's fascinating to kind of peel back how intermingled security, politics, and the military has become within these countries.
Okay, thank you. Derek, what were some of the surprises you found when you were researching this?
Well, I think sort of just tagging along with that, it was fascinating to see dispositionally where their forces are concentrated in. You can figure with a lot of these regimes, particularly the ones that are more authoritarian, you can figure that a lot of their troops will be around the capital. But it was interesting to see that, to map it out, and to get a real look and sort of tagging along with what Michael said, that also you get a real look that these countries aren't really able to prosecute a long war against each other. And that's very, very encouraging, because otherwise, if you follow the headlines and you're too worried about it, you see, of course, these conflicts that break out, 2021, 2022 in particular, was very, very concerning. That doesn't mean that there's not a whole lot of destruction that can come from it. But there's only so long that these sides can actually carry out a military operation before there's just nothing further that they can do, before they can't get very far. That, in my opinion, pushes both Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, who amongst the Central Asia Five, there are the two most likely to clash with one another. It pushes them towards resolving things peacefully, pushes them to the table and provide, it shows both of them that there is no military solution to the disputes that they have, regarding unresolved areas of the border, regarding water access. That's very, as I said, that's very, very encouraging, because you look elsewhere in the world, and obviously we've seen a lot of either frozen conflicts suddenly turn hot, or areas where disputes all of a sudden turned into one country saying, it's time for us to hash this out on the battlefield. In this case, at least, it seems that that's not very much of a risk. Again, there's certainly a low scale conflict that can happen, but neither is going to be attempting to march on the other's capital. They can't come anywhere close.
Okay, that's good. Wow, it's kind of an optimistic note, so it's a good place to end. Although I need to ask the last question: which country report will be the next one that comes out?
So the next one out will be Uzbekistan, which is one of the most convoluted and fascinating militaries out of all five. So Uzbekistan comes out, then Kyrgyzstan, then Turkmenistan, and we're finishing up with Kazakhstan, the biggest one last and the smallest one first. But Uzbekistan is the next one because it is kind of the centerpiece of the entire region. That's been absolutely fascinating to put together and look at how it's changed just under the Mirziyoyev era.
Okay, excellent. And a good reason to have you back on the show again as soon as these reports come out. But for now, thank you, Derek, and thank you, Michael, for being on the program. And a reminder, you can find the report on the Armed Forces of Tajikistan and the other reports that are soon to be released by visiting the Oxus Society website at Oxus Society, that's one word, oxussociety.org. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Major Leagues podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Major Leagues podcast or the Central Asia and Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you much, and we'll be back in the future. Bye-bye.